As tensions between Israel and the US escalate yet further, we speak to two legends of American politics. We have David Axelrod and Mike Murphy. The hacks on tap are on Unholy. I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London.
And I'm Yonit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv. Unholy Two Jews on the News. Really looking forward to that conversation later in the program. What are we going to call it? A podcasting double date?
It's a bit like that, because they're a podcasting duo of legendary standing. It was actually you who got me into that and to Hacks on Tap.
Thank you for admitting that. I was wondering if you had conveniently forgotten that, or did you
very much not. Very much not. And I am a complete devotee of that brilliant podcast, and we are lucky enough to have both of them with us later on. So there's tons to talk about.
Yes, of course. They also do the podcast with Robert Gibbs. Next time we have to improve and do it with the five of us, but now it's going to be the four of us coming on later. You know, these kind of are the days where we cling to any kind of escapism, right? So there's only one question I have for you this week, Jonathan Friedland. Where is Kate?
Oh, the Kate
I know you
saga.
Know. I know you know because you're British and you're a journalist and you write thrillers for a living. I know you know the real answer and you're hiding it from me. And that just makes me feel, it offends me, really. I've had really the crazy conversations. Even in this country, we're in a war and you cannot believe, you know, people calling me up with their theories.
It's completely gone wholly international there. And I saw the video of the two of them, her and William, visiting this farm shop. And the second I looked at it, I thought, that's not going to convince people. People are going to say that's not really her, because she did look a tiny bit different, just in the sense that people always do. And I thought that people are going to say it's deep fake. And sure enough, within seconds, it had the whole purpose of it was obviously a PR exercise to reassure people. It didn't do the job. No, I think it's acting as this quite useful sort of outlet for people who are, you know, share our obsessions, that it's one of those things that you can sort of obsess over and it isn't, you know, horrible or really important. And that's the job of escapism. Usually sport does that, but people have done that about Kate. Look, at the center of it is something, you know, really difficult for her. She's obviously had some medical thing and she's recovering from that. But in her world, being a royal, that's never good enough. And so people obsess. The latest twist on it was that, you know, staff at the hospital where she was admitted, there is an allegation that they were trying to, you know, look into her medical records to see exactly what it was. Probably part, you know, was it curiosity or was it they were thinking that will sell? The people who did the big picture, they'll have got money for it, the photograph and the video and so on. This is an industry, but it's been one of those things that is just kept people fixated all over the world, even where you are, where you really do have other things to think about.
Maybe we do. Another thing people were really obsessing about, but in the Jewish world specifically, we're getting a Jewish James Bond. I think this is a milestone. The first Jewish James Bond, Aaron Taylor Johnson, British actor, rumored to be the next James Bond. You kind of know that the first Jewish James Bond film is going to be called Still Not a Doctor.
That's very, very good.
I think it works.
Still Not a Doctor. That's very good. Or, you know, his brother's a lawyer. That could be the sequel. That could be the Quantum of Solace equivalent.
I think it's very important that we're doing this podcast because this is what we need to be talking about instead of all of the other things we need to be talking about.
Yeah, this is the big news. We will get into look, one of the big running stories, which is this increasing fallout between Washington and Tel Aviv with our guests. We'll talk about that. And there's so much to say about all of that. But on the ground, in a way, it just comes round and round and round.
Yeah, it's Groundhog Day. I mean, really, I would think of anyone not being in Israel for a few weeks coming back and the news is the same, right? The hostage deal is still stuck. The IDF returns to Al-Shifa Hospital because Hamas has returned to Al-Shifa Hospital. There's no solution in the north. Many Israelis still displaced. We're not moving forward. And honestly, the only thing that seems to be moving forward, but moving forward down a cliff, as you said, is the relationship between Biden and the Biden administration and the Netanyahu government. So after we recorded on Thursday, of course, a watershed speech by Senator Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, and the highest ranking Jewish elected official calling for Israeli elections, this had harsh reactions, particularly in Netanyahu's own party, accusing Schumer of interfering with internal issues of an ally. Netanyahu himself, in front of the Knesset, slamming the what he called some in Israel that are cooperating with the Americans to prevent an entry into Rafah. In any case, it is very clear that we are in a situation when we look at all of the, you know, things that are being said out loud or not out loud, we are in a very tumultuous point in the relationship between these two people and between the administrations.
Yeah, that was a huge thing. As you say, it came after we had
very,
spoken.
Very inconsiderate of Senator Schumer to do that after we had recorded our podcast last week. I'm just noting that.
Mark him down for that. A really significant speech, particularly because it was coming from him, somebody who is, and he declared it himself in this very long and sort of heartfelt, nuanced speech that he had. He was speaking absolutely as a friend of Israel in his kishkas, as Joe Biden might put it, and yet he just had obviously reached that breaking point. We'll talk with our guest later about the politics of all that. It came, meanwhile, as on the other side of the aisle, Donald Trump was scathing about Jews who vote Democratic, suggesting they sort of hated themselves, that the only, you know, good Jews were those who supported him, and the rest could be written off. So one way or another, it is such a dominant theme currently in American politics, and we'll talk about that with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy later on in the podcast. But the point of friction now is over the question of arms supplies from the United States to Israel. Partly under pressure from Congress last month, Joe Biden changed the rules that said anybody who receives U.S. military aid has to commit in writing to abide by international law, and that would include a pledge to facilitate, not stand in the way of, delivery of humanitarian aid. The America's ambassador to Israel, Jack Lew, has signed a letter saying, yep, Israel promises that they are in compliance. Normally that would be enough, but that is not the case this time. The US administration wants to certify for itself that Israel is indeed allowing the delivery of humanitarian aid. Now, last week, we said on the podcast that Daniel Hagari, the IDF spokesman, has briefed the international press saying, you know, we're going to flood the zone with aid. Gaza is going to be flooded with aid. It was written up as this dramatic pivot in the Israeli position. As far as the rest of the world is concerned, that hasn't happened. People haven't seen that. There have not been pictures on the news of hundreds of trucks rolling through in line with what Hagari had promised, this flood of aid. And therefore, the Americans are saying, we need to see the proof of this before we will say, yeah, you're good to go, and the arms supplies continue. And that the deadline for that, under these rules, is Sunday. So that is, you know, serious business. And the sort of sounds around it, the noise around it, the noises around it are not good for Israel. You had Tony Blinken, Secretary of State, saying 100% of the Gazan population are in acute need of food and at risk of starvation. You had the head of USAID, the main American governmental aid agency, Samantha Power, saying that the Gaza is on the brink of famine. These are senior US government officials. This is not NGOs or UN groups that Israelis could dismiss as anti-Israel. And, you know, it's not significant in terms of volume, but Canada, not a big arms supplier to Israel in terms of amount, have said they are not going to supply arms anymore. You know, an important ally of Israel. And therefore, a straw in the wind that allies of Israel can say no to sending arms. And the cause in all places around the world, media and in, you know, governmental corridors, is about this issue of hunger and aid and famine. That's the point of tension. And you've even got Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, saying words aren't enough. It's action that matters. So you know, it's not impossible that, I would say it's unlikely that America won't in the end certify and send more arms. I suspect that's what Joe Biden will do. But the fact we have got to this point that because of world outrage and shock at what is being called a risk of a man-made famine in Gaza, the America, Israel's number one ally, there is at least discussion, talk of turning off the supply of arms.
So I want to say a few things about this. You're right that the link is made, that this discussion about the supply of arms is completely and directly connected to the situation in Gaza. We did speak last week about Daniel Hagari's at length, about Daniel Hagari's statement saying we're flooding Gaza with aid. Now, this is what Israel did. I would try and argue that this has now become more a PR problem than a strategic problem, because Israel did open Route 96, which is the route that brings in aid from the north, actually from the area of tragically devastated Be'eri, into northern Gaza. And indeed, Blinken said yesterday in Saudi Arabia, we've seen some progress, including a new access point that was opened. He meant that. There was a documented attempt by the IDF to bring in international correspondents to Kerem Shalom to show that kind of long line of trucks coming in. Of course, the cooperation going on with the peer, CENTCOM and the IDF trying to bring in aid. I think some of this is indeed the IDF making that attempt, but maybe not showing it enough to the world. Definitely something that Israel needs to focus on. If it said that it needs to flood, that wants to flood the area, it has to show that it's flooding the area. Look, Israel is very concerned, and that is clear, about the prospect of some sort of arms conversation. Even the mere conversation of it happening in the Democratic Party, I think, is a problem for Israel. Even the decision, if the decision at the end, and I think you're right about what the decision will be, but I think that is a problem. It has to do with Israel thinking about what the next moves in the war are, and I think it, vis-a-vis what's happening in the north, that is a critical question. I think we should look deeper into what is actually happening and what is always the gap between what Netanyahu is saying and what Netanyahu is doing. I mean, look at how interesting this is. On the one hand, Netanyahu is speaking to a gathering of Republican senators. Chuck Schumer didn't let him speak to the Democratic senators, and he's saying there, Schumer's speech is wholly inappropriate. There are people around the prime minister saying that the United States should focus on toppling Hamas and not toppling the Israeli government. This is all better bellicose rhetoric. But what is Netanyahu actually doing, Jonathan? He's sending, right, his top men and his closest advisors, Ron Dermer and Tzachi Hanegbi, the national security advisor, to Washington with the plans to invade Rafah. Now, what does that actually mean? If we turn back the clock 5 months, remember, Secretary Blinken sat in a meeting of an Israeli war cabinet in the first time in history and looked at the war plans. The United States sent aircraft carriers here. Why am I saying all this? Because Israel is clearly dependent upon the United States in this conflict from day one. That is the situation that was created. Maybe that was the situation required. But Netanyahu allowed for this. He knew it then and he knows it now. So I don't see how this continues. That's what I'm trying to say. Even with a maverick like Netanyahu, that internally he's saying all these bellicose statements about how he's standing tough in front of the United States while sending his own advisors to the United States to essentially show them the war plan. So at the end of the day, something's got to give here. And when he says something as significant as there are elements in Israel cooperating with the United States to prevent an invasion of Rafah, what he's actually, I think, in a way saying, if we're going to have to stop the war, he's preparing that as an excuse. I wanted a total victory, but there were elements here that were cooperating with the United States to prevent me from arriving at that total victory.
Yeah, that's a good reading of how he operates, that he's preparing the blame. And that's in keeping with him and how he rolls. Just on the point about sending his political lieutenants, Ron Dermer, Tzachi Hanegbi, there are some in Washington who think that itself showed he wasn't serious, because he, instead of sending Jake Sullivan had said he was expecting, this interagency team of military intelligence, humanitarian officials who would talk tachlis, if I can use that term on the podcast, about getting the aid in,
etc. Where can
you
use it if not on two podcasts?
If not on Unholy. Instead, he's sending people who will make the political case, rhetorical figures. I'm not sure, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but in terms of how Washington see it, I'm not sure that impressed them of Netanyahu's seriousness. The only point I would make is, it's all about this this hunger and famine issue is massive outside Israel. Inside Israel, people talk about the day after and various other things. All people can see outside, and this is what Biden and Blinken, Sullivan, Power, they're all responding to because it's their constituents. All they can see is one aid official after another, whether it's UN, World Food Programme, after another, saying it's famine, it's starvation, it's man-made. Even people who were, who had got their heads around the military offensive, bombardment and so on, are drawing the line at this. So it's a massive political headache. By the way, just we should clock. It seems as if the IDF themselves are aware of this, and they have reports this week that they have expanded the office there that deals with the threat of international prosecutions, and mindful perhaps of the International Court of Justice, which we remember one of its provisional measures was you've got to get humanitarian aid through. So even though Israel is convinced the 96th gate and so on, that it's letting lots in, outside the perception is that not nearly enough aid is in and that there is a famine. Israel has to deal with that perception because it is, in diplomatic and political terms, a very serious reality now.
Okay, we've set the stage, but now let's go into all that with our special guest this week.
David Axelrod is a former senior advisor in the White House and chief strategist to not one but two successful presidential campaigns for Barack Obama, now an analyst on CNN and co-host of Hacks on Tap.
And Mike Murphy is a political consultant with a reputation burnished over several decades, a former advisor to John McCain, Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush, Arnold Schwarzenegger, can't forget that, among many others. He also is the co-host of Hacks on Tap, and we're very glad to have them both on.
We are delighted to have you both, gentlemen. It is a kind of podcast double date because it's two co-hosts with two co-hosts. There's a lot of geometry here. But I was going to kick off with you, David, because we've been talking a lot, Yoni and I, over the weeks and months about Joe Biden and how he deals with this situation. I'm interested to know whether you think there is any moment, because we can see his frustration, do you think there comes a moment, any scenario, where he picks up the phone to Benjamin Netanyahu and says, I've asked nicely, that hasn't seemed to work, enough is enough, I'm going to cut off the arms supplies now?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that he will be under enormous pressure to do that if Netanyahu continues to thumb his nose at him. I think that Biden, look, I think in his very being, he is a natural and strong supporter of Israel, believes in Israel. I think when he flew there, it was not a political mission. I think it was a mission of heart and soul. But he did offer an admonition even on that day when he arrived, which is don't make the mistake that America made. Don't get so carried away with vengeance and retribution that you create other issues for yourself. And I think that Netanyahu is very much trying Biden's patience.
What was your reading, by the way, of Senator Schumer's speech? Which was, it was a watershed. Yeah. What did you think?
Yeah, listen, I think that... I keep saying you can hold two thoughts at once. And I speak as, my father was a refugee from the pogroms. And, he could talk from firsthand experience about stepping over dead bodies and looking for bread and having his home blown up. So I feel very strongly about Israel and was appalled and sickened and outraged and beyond words about what happened on October 7th. And I believe Israel has the right to defend itself. But you can hold two thoughts at once. You can feel that way and still be heartbroken and sickened by the images of Palestinian children and, the sort of devastation there. I don't object to the essence of that critique by Senator Schumer that more discretion should have been applied and should be applied, even as Israel pursues their attackers. But where I probably would have drawn the line is on the issue of Israeli elections. I think it was a mistake for him to insert himself there. And had I been advising him, I would have told him, no, I don't think I would go there, because the last thing you want to do is sort of turn this into sort of a kind of colonial question, like we're going to tell you how to run your internal politics. I think that was probably too far.
Mike, how are you seeing all this?
Yeah, it's a complicated mix, because on one hand, you have the national security dimension. And on the other hand, you have domestic politics in both places at a fever pitch. You've got Netanyahu's in political trouble, but a crisis like this holds him in office. On our side, you have pressure, particularly on the Democratic side, from younger voters who are not as lockstep pro-Israel as American Democrats used to be. And you have a nervous White House and a very tough reelect, with almost a poll coming out every day that's, you know, scary. So the political people are squeezing, I'm sure. Can't Netanyahu declare victory and tamp this thing down? Because we've been there, you know, under the coals, and we're taking hits here. How long can this go on? Don't make us throw away our reelect because Benjamin Netanyahu has the foot on the gas for his own political reasons. That's how political people think, you know, through the prism. So I think, you know, to your earlier question to David, would the president ever call up Netanyahu and do that? I don't think he would, but in these situations, you know, allies have a way of communicating, hopefully mostly privately, but also through the press. It's kind of like going to the chimpanzee house and trying to interpret all the grunts and gestures. So we're in a deep grunt and gesture thing going on where there's public kind of hints and pushes back channel. I don't think there's an ultimatum, but there's definitely pressure. I mean, the one thing that would be a huge mistake in policy would be to publicly threaten that, because if the Israelis were ever completely isolated, their security situation gets a lot worse and all their enemies are encouraged. So, you know, as a stalwart ally of Israel, I'm sure all Biden's foreign policy people are saying, we can't go to there, particularly publicly. You know, we can't give oxygen to the enemies, but back channel, it's time. And this has happened in the American-Israeli relationship before, Nixon administration, particularly in 73 and 74. So my guess is there's a lot of quiet arm twisting. And because the American and Israeli political communities are linked, there's probably a lot of back channel stuff coming from other Israeli political leaders saying, we got a BB problem here, turn up the heat a little. You know, the big political clock is ticking for everybody. And beyond the strategic imperatives, the politicians in Biden's world who would like to see him reelected, and I think Schumer's a good example, are getting more and more nervous and just don't want to accept the status quo for weeks more.
I just think that, first of all, Mike's absolutely right. This is a complicated matrix because you have electoral politics over, you know, overarching these or overhanging these judgments both here and there. I do think that there will be more and more of a public clamor, particularly among some elements of the Democratic Party on this issue. And there are some senators who have already said so on this issue of funding. If the Israelis brush Biden's concerns aside. And then there is the other issue that Mike hints at, which is that Netanyahu is, there's going to be based on, and this is not me saying what should happen, this is what's going to happen. There's going to be a judgment once this war is over about how it happened and about him. And he knows that. The thing that Schumer did for him was to give him a foil, because I'm sure no matter where you are on the spectrum in Israel, you know, you don't want Americans sort of telling Israelis when they should hold their elections, and Bibi jumped all over that. So in that sense, Schumer was did Bibi a favor.
Schumer. Looking at that, I looked at that and I said, does he realize he's helping him? Like, does he realize that what he's saying is actually bolstering Netanyahu inside Israel?
It was my first reaction to that.
Very specifically, actually, because of that point you made about the line about you now need to hold an election. That's where he got into the meddling. But if we're talking about Schumer and Netanyahu, Yoni has a most fabulous story about those two.
I heard this from the person, the person in the room who's a leader in the Jewish community. This happened in the 80s, okay? So Schumer was a congressman. He had just renovated his house in in Brooklyn. Netanyahu, obviously an up-and-coming shiny ambassador in the UN, was invited to dinner and then tried to explain to the people sitting there that what the Middle East is. So he took a big bottle of Pepsi Cola, shook it, you know, and said, the Middle East, if it's contained, it's fine. And then opened it and said, but this is what happens when it's not. And the whole thing sprayed on the ceiling of the newly renovated house of Chuck Schumer. And that was the last time Netanyahu was ever invited, according to the people in the room who watched this. So that was the beginning of the relationship.
Well, yeah, not but sure Schumer just opened up his own can and it spilled all over his own ceiling here, I think.
No, just we have a problem, and I think most democracies too, that our powerful legislative leaders often see no reason why they should not enter the world stage, and they're not that sophisticated in it. Nancy Pelosi going to Taiwan, that was a bungle. Schumer deciding to jump in the middle of this thing. You know, it's just irresistible for them because they're so important in domestic politics. They figure, well, about time for the UN to hear from me too. And I think that is a time-tested thing that is just a mistake, but here we are, you know, and I'm sure there are Israeli politicians who'd love to come talk to the Republican Congress and stir all that up against Biden.
As we speak, Speaker Johnson has confirmed that he is going to invite Netanyahu to speak to Congress. You know, I would say you're right that these guys are not, you want the officials of government to speak for the country on these national security issues, the administration to speak for them. But Schumer and Johnson also are concerned about reelecting their members. And so they're playing their own politics here. I think, by the way, just my opinion, what a dreadful mistake that would be if Netanyahu came here and addressed the Congress. I thought it was a mistake when he came here before the vote on the Iran nuclear treaty. You know, it had always been for years and years and years the consensus, notion of the Israeli governments that not to involve itself in American domestic politics. And I understand Schumer crossed this line, but this seems like a terrible idea at a time when you have a Democratic president to come and a Democratic Senate to come here and plunge into the politics of this country. And I hope he's smart enough not to do it.
It'll only weaken Israel's position vis-a-vis the American alliance, because it's a vortex that, as David said, it's always been a bipartisan consensus to have a strong, you know, alliance with Israel. And when you start picking the partisan side, for every friend you make an enemy. And it would be a dreadful mistake for Netanyahu to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of, though, a long pattern with him, which is almost, whether it's deliberate or not, but to turn Israel into a partisan issue. That's the thing that Netanyahu has broken over these two, you know, 10, 15 years. He's been doing that, you know, it began in earnest in the Obama period. I mean, in a way, this goes to a question about, you know, wider politics, whether that ship has perhaps already sailed. And I was going to ask you both whether you think Israel has become another culture war issue in a way like mask wearing was during COVID, where if you're blue, you line up for the Palestinians, especially if you're younger. And if you're in a red state, you line up for the Israelis. And it's just now going to be one of those indicators about where you are, what TV you watch, what brand of coffee you drink.
Right.
It's going to be a distant memory when Israel was something that Americans could agree on.
I'm not sure the ship has sailed, but it's definitely become unmoored and it's kind of floating around the harbor basin. There's a fracture in the relationship, and pouring gasoline on it like this would be a critical mistake. I'm sure there are people, grown-ups in the Israeli security establishment, are saying, how isolated can we allow ourselves to become? We're losing the EU fast. We already have problems in other areas. The Chinese want disorder. The Russians want disorder. And now we're getting in a political spat with the Americans. You know, they should read their Churchill, stay close to the Americans, because that is the ticket. I have to wonder, Bibi's personal interests are very much intertwined politically, you know, with the strategic situation. And I hope he has his priorities straight when he's making these decisions.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I also agree with Mike that I know the Democratic party pretty well. I mean, yeah, there's no doubt there's an age divide. And I'm sitting right now on the campus of the University of Chicago. I spoke to a bunch of students this morning, and they, students who are supportive of Biden and are fending off classmates who, you know, are talking about Genocide Joe. And that, that meme is being sold on TikTok, and probably not just by citizens wanting to express themselves, but also by malign actors who want to roil the waters of American politics. But I think that there are a lot of Democrats, and this is why ultimately it was a mistake for Netanyahu to come. And Mike sort of hinted at this. There are a lot of Democrats who want to support Israel and continue to support Israel, and it's getting harder. And if he comes and turns it into a partisan fight, I think it's going to be really, really hard for them to stick with it. So the question is, as it always is with Bibi, is he going to put the country first, or is he going to put his own politics first? It'll be interesting to see.
Well, we have a little saying that we've learned in the Republican Party of don't force a politician to choose between what they know is right and their primary voters. Yeah. And that is a good calculus for Bibi to have in his mind before he starts setting this ablaze.
You know, I had a friend from the think tank world in Washington come to Israel, and he said to me, Biden might lose because of Israel, and that is going to be a disaster. So I guess my question, Mike, to you first, and then to you, David, can he lose because of Israel?
He can lose, but I don't think it's because of Israel. That said, mm-hmm. if this thing is bungled and the prime minister of Israel decides to join MAGA and jump into the American elections as a polarizer, it is going to be a political problem for Biden. And it is not. I hope Bibi doesn't think the answer is get to Israel to solve the problem, because Biden's political people will say more distance, push back hard on Israel to solve the problem. So there's no blackmailing Biden back, but it could create more political pain if Bibi bungles this thing.
Listen, Biden won young people by, if you, people under 30, probably by 20 points or so last time. And now it's pretty close to even. And this has been, you know, there are perhaps other issues that that play into this, economic issues and so on. But this has become a flare point for younger voters, and who don't, they haven't grown up with the history that older voters have, or a sense of Israel as, you know, as the sort of fledgling democracy that it was. And, you know, their experiences, they've grown up with Bibi Netanyahu, and they are passionate about human rights. This is going to be a marginal race. And if young people stay away from the polls, I don't think they're going to go to Trump. They could go to a third party candidate. But if they stay away and they're not in Biden's column, or their turnout is quite low or relatively low among younger voters, I'm not willing to say that it couldn't be a decisive matter. It is. This is a real thing in American politics right now.
And just to push it even more specific, I know both of you are, you know, involved in and watch closely the state of Michigan. And that one state, even if you don't get the big picture nationally that you just talked about younger and more progressive voters, could Arab American voters alone in Dearborn, Michigan.
200,000 Arab American voters in the state of Michigan.
Right. And their fury at this enabling of Netanyahu by Biden, as they would see it, that alone surely could swing this whole contest. No?
Yeah. It's a major factor. Michigan's the most interesting state of the five or six that'll decide. That's the largest Arab American community in the country. That's Wayne County, which is also Detroit, which the Democrats have to win by significant large double digits to offset outstate. And Biden, if the election were held tomorrow, I think Biden would lose Michigan. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is a flashpoint. And, you know, I think David and I would both agree that there are political people at the White House who, appropriately, it's their job. Their map of the world is only six states. So they know this is a pain point, and they're pushing back to solve it. And you can see Biden getting a little distance now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so when you combine the effect on Arab American voters in the Detroit area and he carried those areas overwhelmingly, Biden, in 2020. And you then go to Ann Arbor and some of the college towns. This is a real factor. He won Michigan by a wider margin than some of the other battleground states in 2020. But I would not sleep on Michigan at all here. And this issue is one of the reasons why.
You've also got the Republicans in the mirror universe saying, hey, let's get Bibi to polarize this. Let's bring him to the House, and we're going to pick up the Jewish vote and push Biden over to Hamas, you know, in perception and attack, which, you know, so they're making the reverse calculation. So if I was an Israeli politician of any stripe, I would want to do anything to avoid that happening.
This is a nightmare scenario. I mean, if this is what happens and Democrats then blame Israel or this issue for their loss, this can be catastrophic for Israel. I don't want to sound too dramatic, but that is...
And pretty bad for American Jews as well, by the way.
You know, speaking as one, it's heartbreaking to me. You know, on the other hand, I mean, like I say, I feel like I'm standing between two conversations, not on this podcast, but I'm standing between two conversations between...
We're three Jews and one honorary Jew. There's like 15 conversations going on.
I'm here to represent the Pope, yes.
So, you know, as I said earlier, I don't want to rob these young people of their passion, including young Jews, by the way. I don't want to rob them of their passion for human rights and their concerns about the Palestinians. At the same time, I want to tell them that when you undergo the kind of attack that Israel did on October 7th, and you've lived over a long period of time with the existential realities that Israel lives with, you have to be sensitive to that as well. I mean, it does lead me to the two-state issue, where I've lived for now, you know, 30 years. And this is, Biden's been driving toward this as well. Bibi's been obviously resistant to it. But I think there is, positions are hardening in a way that is scary.
This takes me back to the question I began with to you, which is the point about Biden. He wants, clearly, he needs this to stop. He just needs this to stop being on the news. You know, he needs this to stop. And his team are constantly putting pressure on Netanyahu, and yet it isn't stopping. He's not able to even get his way on, for example, increased aid or whatever, in terms of how it's seen. Doesn't that create another problem, almost regardless of the position you take on the merits, which is it seems to advertise his weakness.
This is such a good point.
And I've heard you both – well, I mean, I was just thinking, Mike, you've sometimes said – I've heard you say several times that strong and wrong beats weak and right, and – isn't this just almost, as I say, putting aside the rights and wrongs of the Middle East as an issue, this daily image of Biden being impotent to stop a loyal ally from acting, isn't that a problem of its own?
It is. It's a big problem for Biden, and it's a problem for Israel, because Biden has more brutal tools to win this fight in the end if he needs to, which would be a disaster for Israel. It would be a disaster for us because it would be a foreign policy defeat. But in the end, Biden's the one who can make it clear that we are telling you to stop. If you want to be totally alone, you can try that. And that would be a disaster in American-Israeli relations that we should never be clumsy enough to get to, but we're inching along that path. My advice to any foreign leader is don't corner a vulnerable American president in a reelect year. And I don't know what guidebook to American politics Bibi's reading. He's a pretty shrewd guy. I've talked to him about American politics years ago. But he is stumbling into a path that benefits Israel's enemies, in my view.
Yeah. It does go back to that question, though, what he thinks benefits him. Jonathan, that is such an important point. You know, the subtext of the whole Republican campaign here is that the world's out of control and Biden's not in command. That's basically their argument. And, you know, age, they use age as a surrogate for weakness. It is unhelpful for him to appear as if Bibi is punking him. And Bibi may see it as helpful to him personally, even if it's not to Israel, to appear to be defiant in the face of American pressure. So it's a very, very fraught dynamic. And as Mike said, you know, Netanyahu should not push too far.
Yeah, if he corners them in the end, Biden's the bigger animal. And again, I'd look at this, who's watching? Hezbollah. And if the Israelis appear to be more and more isolated, particularly from the Americans, it will change their power calculus. And, you know, then this thing could spiral in a really bad way.
Yeah. You said Israel, in the words Israel and isolated a lot, Mike, and I'm wondering, first of all, I have to ask you about, someone like me who's been following you on Twitter for a very long time has noticed that you changed your profile picture to the Israeli flag and it says, I stand with Israel. And I remember seeing it and thinking that's a very brave, sadly, thinking that's a very brave move to make, because it does seem like, however we managed to do this, us Israelis, right? We've been brutally attacked on October 7th, and now we're at a time where The Economist puts up a cover story saying Israel alone. Just on, you know, your two legendary strategists, I know you both help candidates and not countries. What is the one advice that you would give us Israelis, that we need to do?
I would say, and I think your smart foreign policy people already know this, first of all, I it didn't feel brave to me. It felt right. It's pretty simple. There was a ceasefire, and then Hamas sent murder squads in to slaughter Israelis. That's a pretty clear narrative to me. I'm not a dreamer about the hard politics of
the ancillary benefit was he took his own picture down, so that was good too.
That's true. My followers quadrupled. But the point to what's in the Israeli interest now is to study other countries' foreign policy moments, and sometimes declaring victory a little earlier and going low grade to work the longer strategy and take 85% of the win when 100% of the win is going to cost you a lot, as frustrating as that might be, is the overwhelming strategic smart move.
Yeah, I would say two things. So, I'm sorry. I would say
no,
two.
No, so that would be how I see it.
I agree with what Mike just said, though I also don't live across the border from Gaza. So, I mean, there was a mission here, and the mission was to try and decommission Hamas as an imminent peril here. There is the question of, are you creating more militants every day as well, which I think one has to worry about. But I also think that the Israelis need to look less like they are resistant to getting aid into Gaza, like they are being grudgingly dragged to it, that they are blind to the humanitarian crisis that is undeniable, and that they are, you know, which I understand there's so much anger about what happened on October 7th, but the images that the world is seeing right now, and this was always a danger, the images that the world is seeing right now do isolate Israel and do convey a sense of callousness and disregard that I think that Israel needs to be aware of. And Israel ought to be on the side of trying to figure out how to keep people from starving to death. It's not enough to say Hamas is using them as human shields. I don't think that's a good enough answer. There needs to be affirmative action to try and get relief to people and save these children from starving and ultimately begin the next phase here of reconstructing Gaza under new leadership and with the assistance of Israel, the U.S., and the world.
Yeah, there's got to be somebody, and I'm sure there's somebody is loudly asking in cabinet, is it possible to win a military victory while you're being overwhelmingly destroyed in the modern era in the information war?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a matter of having better algorithms.
Right.
So, you know, is that a victory? Because it's a different battlefield now.
See, I think both of what you've said would penetrate if you were talking about a leader who wasn't, to your point earlier, David, thinking not about the national interest, but about his own personal interest. And so when you were saying about beware of cornering a president in a reelect, true, unless you think your own personal interest is served by that president perhaps losing and Donald Trump taking his place. I mean, that may be the calculation. We haven't talked about Trump much. I wanted to get your reaction, both of you, to these remarks that Trump made this week. Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves, Donald Trump said. To you, Mike, you mentioned before that some Republicans might be thinking there's a Jewish vote they can win over if they can slap the Hamas label on Joe Biden. Whether Jewish Republicans at any point hear Donald Trump talk like that and think, you know what, whatever the position on Israel, we just can't vote for a guy who talks like this about us.
Well, I think there's some of that, but there's also American politics are now pick a team no matter what. And if it is perceived that Biden is backing off supporting Israel, pressuring the Israel president in a war situation driven by massive and brutal terrorist attacks, and weak Joe Biden is now squabbling with him because he's being too tough, he's being too Trumpian, I think it's a very simple theme for the Republicans, and I think they'd be very happy to prosecute it and think they will win votes that way. There has been a 20-year effort in the Republican Party to increase the Jewish vote, and it has worked. It has increased. So there is an appetite fueled by a perception of success. It's one of the reasons that Republicans think they've taken Florida from a swing state to a red state. They give Trump credit. So things are starting to fall into that polarized thing, as we spoke about before, and it is a challenge. Don't expect subtlety from the modern Republican Party in an election.
Let me just say that what Mike's saying might be true, but I can't tell you how repugnant that was to me as a Jew, and I'm a secular Jew. I'm not services every week, but I am proud of my faith and my religion. I have family members who've suffered for it. I told you that and came here to practice their faith freely, and it was outrageous. I mean, not to say the least of which is, like, who is Donald Trump to lecture anyone on issues of faith and religion and piety? And, you know, I can't think of a more irreligious person on the planet. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a guy who's violated 11 of the 10 commandments. So I don't want to hear from him. I don't need any lectures from him about my commitment to Judaism. And I think there are a lot of Jews in America who feel the same way.
We know that you're both very busy and you have to go. I can't not ask you, David, what did you feel in seeing this sort of tsunami that surprised all of us, I think, of anti-Semitism in the United States sort of erupting after October 7th?
Well, this is, first of all, there was a low-grade tsunami that's been rolling for some time now. So let's put it in perspective. This has been a growing, welling problem before. What's really troubling to me is among young people and on these on campuses, what we've seen. And, you know, what people have done is they've merged Judaism and the Jewish faith with the policies of the Netanyahu government. And some of these images out of Gaza, the same people who are horrified, you know, about the sort of hate and characterizations of Muslims are now engaging in some of the same tactics and succumbing to the same impulse. And it's really, really troubling. But I think back to Charlottesville and people marching there saying Jews will not replace us, and the encouragement that Trump has given to some of the extremes in our country, including, people who for whom anti-Semitism, an array of groups. And, you know, this has been welling up for a long time. But the thing that bothers me is that young people who are the future and who should know better are now being drawn into this, and it's something that we have to really address.
And Mike, just as we're closing one to you, I suppose there's nothing more that Trump can do to alienate you because you crossed over a long while ago, but just those remarks just remind you why you did.
Do you think he's doing this podcast from a car? He has to keep moving.
I stay near the Canadian border at all times, never more than 40 miles away. Yeah, I've hated Trump since 93 when I was running politics for my client, the governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, and he was in Atlantic City doing terrible things. So I'm old guard on this question, and I'm as incensed as David. Let me say, I am not Jewish. I'm a Roman Catholic, but anybody who's seen me, and David has put away a pastrami Reuben at Manny's, knows I'm only 1/1,000,000,000th of an inch away from full on. And
anybody who sees us knows anybody who sees us knows he's not lying about that either. But
actually, there's some question in the family because my great grandfather, we think was probably Jewish. But anyway, the question at hand, of course, is trying to pass. Trump fail. Oh, I've seen you at an Episcopal country club.
Yes.
Argyle
sweater. Yes, I'm there all the time.
yeah, no, you're a regular. Yeah. Says his name is Trey to anybody who meets him. Look, Trump fails every moral question, okay? He's only religious in a satanic sense. So I totally agree. It's incredibly repugnant. That's why I'm going to hold my nose as a card-carrying rock rib conservative. I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. But I have anesthetized myself to that anger just to look at the practical politics of it, because that's the only way to beat the guy, to focus on that. And I will say a little hopeful note here. If the smart, which means widening the cult of Bibi in the Israeli government, it's time for some people in the cabinet to really stand up in the Israeli national interest. But if the smart folks in Israel play this right, the alliance will emerge stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Israel's position will increase. And I think we can make the relationship stronger going forward and deal with these things. But we got to get the petty vanities of a cornered Israeli politician out of the center of the equation.
I know
that is a problem only, not Chuck Schumer, but only Israel can solve.
I know you gave Mike the last word, but I can't never let him have the last word. So I just want to add that for the sake of Israel, for the sake of Israeli troops, for the sake of the Palestinians, innocent Palestinians who've been drawn into this, and for the sake of the future relationship, this sort of sacred bond between our countries, one has to hope for a resolution sooner rather than later. And the longer it draws on, I think the more problematic it becomes.
And let me get the last word after that last word. Thank you guys for having us on the podcast. I just did it to irritate him.
All right, mission accomplished.
Gotcha.
Okay. Good to be with you all.
Now we have been fans of yours for such a long time, you guys. Thank you so much for talking to us.
All right, thank you.
David Axelrod, Mike Miller from Murphy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you both. So, listeners to Unholy, now you know why we're hooked on Hacks on Tap. Murphy and Axelrod, legends of the political game, legends now of the podcasting game. And just hearing them, you realize how much the politics of what's going on in this war and in Israel is become intertwined with American politics in an election year.
Listen, I can listen to those two for hours, really. And I think that it's important to hear kind of the different perspectives on how to look not only on the Chuck Schumer speech, but on everything that is happening in the political arena in the United States vis-a-vis the situation here in Israel. Always such a pleasure to listen to them. It has been my dream. I've been harboring this dream to have them on for a long time. So I'm very glad it panned out. Shall we go into our awards?
Yeah, we should. I'm still reeling, by the way, from that fantastic story about the bottle of Pepsi in the Schumer residence, partly because it's an amazing echo of the fantastic and apparently, grounded in truth story recalled in Joshua Cohen's novel, The Netanyahu's. Another recommendation from the Yonit Levy Book Club, and not only Hacks on Tap podcast, but you told me to read The Netanyahu's by Joshua Cohen. And it's about the appalling house guests when they arrive and how terribly they behave, ruining the place. And now we know. That was actually the main protagonist there was Netanyahu's father. Now we know Netanyahu, the son, is just as much of a boor, B-O-O-R, when he visits. So fantastic to hear that, as well as mirth and axe in conversation. So award season, it's always award season on Unholy. What, I think it's your turn.
It is, and I will give you my chutzpah nominee for this week, a man we have not talked about in this podcast at all. The Prime Minister of Israel. But this is a specific story that we kind of like. It started this week when he complained that Israel's PR suffers because he's surrounded by people who can't put two words together in English. We reported this, Channel 12 reported this from a meeting he had in the Knesset. This while at the very same time, deciding to suspend English language spokesman Ilan Levy, that I think we can agree was particularly useful and good and a professional during this conflict. The reason for his suspension was him posting an answer to David Cameron, Foreign Secretary, UK Foreign Secretary. Not a polite thing to do, but I mean, if we're in the competition of 50 mistakes made on Twitter by Israeli officials in the last 5 months, I'm not sure this leads him to the top, you know, 20 places. In the background, obviously, a report by our correspondent on Channel 12, Daphne Liel, saying that Sarah Netanyahu has long wanted to suspend Ilan Levy for the fact that he has been a supporter of the protests against the judicial coup. So it kind of looks to the naked eye like someone was looking for a reason to actually do it. While, again, the prime minister is complaining that there is not enough people who speak good English to explain Israel's case to the world.
Yes, a worthy if serial winner of our Chutzpah Award for Mensch. I don't know whether they have received this award before. Perhaps they have. I think our nominee this week is Israel's Supreme Court. And they all can share the award together because they unanimously ruled that the Population Authority of Israel, people particularly who you know, register births, deaths and marriages, as it were, must register both members of a lesbian couple as the mothers of their shared children. They said that the failure by the authority to do that sent a message that somehow, as they put it, non-biological parenting is inferior to the other kind. So, you know, a small step towards progress from Israel's Supreme Court and doing it unanimously so they can collectively gather in their chambers and admire the coveted Unholy Mensch of the Week award that is heading their
I'm
way.
Sure this is and happening in reality.
Yeah, it's a nice image, isn't it? But of course, we talked about the court so much in 2023. It was the center of what we thought was going to be the big, you know, political and story out of Israel in that year. And in the end,
I wish we were
changed.
Still talking about the courts, but we're not anymore. We should actually mention that we talked about this extensively last week, Jonathan Glazer's speech, and we had Danny Cohen on, who's the president of one of the companies that financed this film and the executive producer of the film. He said that he disagrees with what Glazer said. After Danny talked, there were a letter coming out of Jewish creatives and professionals now denouncing Jonathan Glazer's speech, more than 1,000 signatures on that letter. So I thought we should mention it. And we are wrapping up our conversation. I think we didn't even mention it's Purim, Jonathan, because this really is not a year of festive Purim. A lot of the Purim parades in this country were canceled due to the, you know, basically mood of the country. But we should say Chag Sameach as much as we can. I have to report to you just in parentheses that a dramatic move in the Levy family, Elsa has been usurped for Rapunzel this week. This year, I know it's dramatic. It's dramatic.
You buried the lead
there. Maybe we should have a whole spin-off pod discussing this.
You hugely buried the lead. Unholy listeners will know that every single year, Yonit has had to traipse around her neighborhood, one way or another, in full Frozen Elsa gear. Probably time for me to admit that I've never seen Frozen. And I know that you've look at the face. Listeners are missing out on the shock, the aghast. It's like Edward Mook's scream.
Seen Frozen?
First of all, you have
no daughters, so this explains why you've never seen Frozen.
Right.
And it's How many times have you seen it?
I've seen it zero times, I'm going to guess that the average between the two of us is 1,000, 2,000?
Maybe 2,000. I think I've seen it. I've seen it many, 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 many times.
Yeah. I think it's time. Well, clearly your daughters have decided it's time to let it go. And they are not wearing the Elsa costume this year. That's the headline. We should have begun with that. Remember, if you are enjoying Unholy, please do tell your friends. This Purim is as good a time as any. Many of you are doing that, and we are grateful.
And we will say our thank yous to Gaia Glaser, Omer Primatz, Omri Barak. Go see Frozen, Jonathan. We'll compare notes next week.